So there's more stuff, and if you can't remember everything, I will publish it afterwards and add some more stuff to it. So I see how far I get. I wouldn't probably be able to cover it all. APIs. What is an API? API stands for Application Programmer Interface, not Application Program Interface. Programmers are actually humans. So when we're designing APIs, we talk about machine-human interaction. So to give you a picture, an API is to the programmer what a graphical user interface is to the end user. So imagine how you design graphical user interfaces and try to apply the same care that you put into graphical user interfaces into your APIs. Example, if you just need a new function somewhere and we can't just go in and add a new button that is totally unrelated and new fields and say, I just didn't use them if you don't want it. Then you end up with K-control. So what are the implications of looking at an API as a user interface, as a human interface? API should be minimal. Can we move it? That's the maximum. API should be minimal. They should be complete. And obviously there might be a conflict. They should have clear and simple semantics. They should be intuitive, whatever intuitive means. They should be easy to memorize. And this is where it differs from a graphical user interface. APIs should guide to readable code that you write against those APIs. So if you look for something similar in graphical user interfaces, a good graphical user interface should guide users to sensible, almost optimal processes, how to do things with the user interface, rather than clumsy things, even if the users find their way. And that's, in a way, the same thing. An API should guide to readable code, to good code, rather than complicated workflows. So I'm now going through all those different items, and I have a slide for all of them. And I'll talk about naming, and then I have, if I still have time, some use cases, some case studies. What does minimal mean? The goal here is to minimize the number of members per class. And at the same time, we want to minimize the number of classes. And obviously there's a conflict, and obviously there's some judgment to do. Excuse me? It makes funny noises. So why would you want to have a minimal API? The point is, it's easy to understand, it's easy to remember, it's easy to rebuild, and easy to change. Classes and a minimal library, you always have to make judgment. For example, if we have a label class, it's probably good to have a label class that can show a pixmap and text, rather than having a cube pixmap label and a cube text label, even if you add more functions to the classes. But sometimes you don't want to add all sorts of stuff to a class. So this is always where judgment comes in. Also consider that overloads, having the minimal number of members per class doesn't mean you shouldn't have convenience overloads. Overloads are, in a way, a trick to get some sort of type dynamics into a pretty statically typed language like C++ is. So overloads are conceptually a lot cheaper than other members. They share the same documentation. What is a complete API? A complete API is, there's just some rules of thumb. If most users of a class miss a certain feature, the API is not complete. Obviously. But always remember minimization. Make sure the feature really belongs into the class. And very often just because you work with something and you need a certain feature, you just put it there because you can't think of a better place to put it. And if that happens, you're on a slippery slope because nasty things tend to grow. So sometimes when we started putting a function in some scope where it didn't quite belong, if you go to the same place a few months later, there will be like 3 functions and you'll get more stuff. The problem with that is that even if your function's useful, and if you don't find the right place for the function, most potential users will not find it, they will not look for it. So you end up with a lot of secret things somewhere in the API that nobody actually finds. Clear and simple semantics. As with any other design work, when you design APIs, apply the principle of least surprise. Yeah, that's pretty obvious. One of the things, what does that mean, for example? It means that you do not want to have protocols. If you have 5 functions that set properties, it shouldn't matter in what order you set those properties. If you change the order, you still should get the absolutely same result. Same with, if you have 1 set of function for a property that changes other properties as well, be very careful, you don't normally want that, because this is where you introduce protocols. This is where just swapping lines in code will actually have big side effects. Next line is very important. Make common tasks easy and rare tasks possible. Sometimes, if you use classes a very complex way and you extend them, you end up making the rare tasks really easy and make the common usage more difficult or more difficult to understand. I have more slides on that one, but keep in mind the common task, what you perceive as the common task, should be the easiest, and everything that's a bit weird and rare must at least be possible, but you don't have to focus on making that easy if it makes the common task. Also, be specific when you solve a specific problem. Often one tries to, if you're used to library programming, you try to abstract way too much, you try to generalize and find the underlying cool concepts rather than solving the problem you want to solve. And sometimes it's good if you come up with a really good abstraction, but coming up with good abstraction takes time, and most often you end up with broken abstractions. I have one example here that's Q-Mindsource Factory. We could have called it Q-Image Loader. And we could say there's a concept of a path or a URL. We called it MindSource Factory because it could load all sorts of mind types. And it didn't have a concept of a path and a file, and it had a concept of a context and an identifier, which was, you know, one step too much abstraction. Or the async.io framework, which really was just written to make asynchronous image loading possible. And not powerful enough to do anything more with the framework. So it's better to keep it specific, if it's specific. If you design libraries and you're not sure about something, remove it. I mean, whenever you remove something, people will complain, but it's better to edit a bit later when you fully understand it. There's no point in rushing some functionality out until you fully understand it. And try to think a little bit more long term when we develop the application library. Intuitive. Everything should be intuitive for computers. Just like computers in itself are not very intuitive. So intuition is I'm always reacting when I hear something should be intuitive, because it's very hard to define that term. Like today it's intuitive if you want to save something, if you click on a symbol that shows a floppy disk. That's true for users even that have never used a floppy disk in their whole lives. So intuition is based on experience and your background. So depending on the background, you have a different perception of what is intuitive. So when we think in terms of intuitive Qt style APIs, I try to come up with 2 definitions that I think are useful. So we say an API is intuitive if a semi-experienced user, Qt user, gets away without reading the docs.
normally using the class, if you just other classes, should be possible without those other names. Just with the name of the functions of the class and the concepts. The second guideline is, if a programmer who does not know Qt can actually understand code written against that API. And I think this is two guidelines that can help some APIs. Eric, you look so skeptical.
No, I'm not skeptical.
APIs should be easy to memorize. Obviously, people should learn an API and stick to it. So the way of doing it is you choose consistent and precise naming. Naming is key. Naming is so important. This is why I have like 10 slides on naming. Try to avoid words that are unknown to non-native speakers. This is mostly to the native speakers in the audience, or to those who sometimes, you know, look up cool words in the dictionary. Most people that use our APIs have learned English as a second or third language, and it's better to have, you know, more common, simpler terms than really cool, precise terms that nobody knows. Third, do not abbreviate. It always looks like a good idea if you can save a few keystrokes, but it makes the stuff more difficult to read. It makes the stuff clumsy. Just don't mind. Just avoid abbreviations. Just makes things more difficult. And of course, use recognizable patterns and concepts. There's no, sometimes you feel like, oh, this concept would just fit perfectly that problem in the moment. But if you just have one class with that concept, it's better to apply a concept to a class that doesn't quite fit as well, but is used among the entire library, because people will just get it for free without having to learn something. An API should guide to readable code. What's the rationale behind it? Code is written once, but it's read, debugged, and understood by different people and yourself many, many times. That's probably even true for your own code. You write it once, a couple of months or years later, you have to do something with it. You read it, you try to understand it again, because you don't remember what your state of mind was when you wrote it. So readable code may sometimes take longer to write, but it saves time throughout the life cycle of it. So there's no point in really optimizing for a minimal amount of keystrokes. But there's a lot of point in optimizing for guiding. Some mindset issues. Stuff you should have in your mind when you design APIs. Picture your target user. Or user interface. And keep in mind that different types of users use different parts of an API and have those users in mind. For example, when you write a component in Qt, there's the common usage, there's users that just instantiate the component, sets some properties, connect some signals and slots and use it. And there's others that want to subclass a component. Usage should be intuitive. That means, again, shouldn't require the docs, should be rather straightforward. But subclassing may actually require reading the documentation. And like I assume when I write a class that somebody wants to subclass the component to do something special will read the documentation. And if you don't, and you mess up, then I don't care. But usage should. On the same page, component authors are expected to have a higher level of conceptual understanding of reading the documentation, understanding the things. So if you design APIs for people that subclass components, they can be slightly more complex, more powerful than just for the user. But there's one group of classes that are only used for subclassing, and where normal usage requires subclassing. And if it does, we now mark the class as abstract. Abstract view classes and classes. There were some places in Qt where normal usage of a class was subclassing, because subclassing is so
So simple, right? I mean, faster targeting, you can just read in the virtual function instead of setting something. We went away from that model. We think it's easier if you can just instantiate a component, set some properties, and that's it, rather than subclassing all. There was an example when you had to do layout in Qt 2.1. Size policy wasn't a property. It was just the virtual getter function. So if you wanted to change the way your components are laid out, you would have to re-implement your component and return a different size policy. Which is cool, and you don't need to store the size policy in the class, so we save like one short per instance. That makes programming. Here comes a very important one. It's based on the misconception that the fewer code necessary to achieve something, the better the end is. And again, remember, code is written only once, but read, debugged, understood many, many times. So I'll give you one example. This is a Qt 3. It's the first two lines. We instantiate the slider with 12, 18, 3, 13, vertical 0, convenience. Very cool to type, isn't it? Very short. Why is that a bad thing? A, if you look at that, you don't know what it means. And ironically, I don't think you even know what it means when you write it. Nobody can actually write that without looking up the documentation. So with a model like this, most programmers spend extra time looking at the documentation. And whenever you read it and you change something, you need to look at the documentation. Now in Qt 4, we are pushing more programming style. We simply instantiate the component, we set properties, and that's it. But again, there is a balance. So you see here, the set range is a convenience function to set the minimum and the maximum. So in that sense, it adds bloat. But since we do it throughout all classes that use minimum and maximum, we believe it's a concept that people can learn and keep in mind. Also, we do have convenience arguments for a constructor where it's understandable. Like if you create a new Q slider, Q, colon, colon, vertical, understanding that this is a vertical slider is rather easy. So why not do it this way instead of saying slider set orientation Q? So it's always a balance. But that code is a lot easier to understand than this code. And it's also easier to write. Consider bindings to dynamically typed languages. Qt is used from Python, it's used from Ruby. I've spoken about that a couple of times. There's Java bindings, there's C# bindings, and there is a chance that those things become more important in the future. So having a model that goes a bit away from the statically typed C++ world with complex, many arguments for functions to a dynamic world is probably a good thing. Because a convenience constructor like this one, you can't have that in a dynamically typed language because you give up all support by the compiler. You could pass Qt vertical in here, and that could be a 12, even if it's mapped to a pointer or something, because everything's dynamic. So you can't do these kind of things in more modern programming. Here's another trap, the Boolean one. This is how the pattern goes. You have a function do something, and now you work with a class, and you need something else. And because you're lazy, you don't want to write an extra function, because you don't want to have extra functions, because functions have bloat. And functions are difficult because you need to write documentation for the function. So what you do, you just add a bool, do something else, and use a default argument in this place. There's very often, if you need something else, sometimes it happens that in the third step you need something entirely different, so you just keep on adding bools. The broken rationale behind is that extra function, no extra function, no extra bloat. Cool. The truth is, you add a lot of load, not to the class, but to the function. The stuff is hard to memorize, and it leads to non-intuitive code. I give you some examples here below. I know you've read it. There's widget has a repaint function that takes a cool false. What does it mean? Flicker? Not erase the background? Sure, you can learn it after a while, but somebody who doesn't understand Qt, don't repaint false. Oh, don't repaint. Or take this one. Ha, I love this one. Set size policy, preferred, expanding, true. Who actually knows what that true means? Raise your hand. Lars knows it. the worst kid in the class was QtextEdit. Based also on user feedback, it ended up with an insert function that had three balls. True, true, false. I have no idea what that means. We fixed that at some point in time, but can you imagine, some users were, of course, annoyed with these things, so I remember I once got a bug report by that. Someone said, oh, if I do insert with true, true, false, this and that happens, but with true, false, true, this happens, and as opposed to false, false, true. Because this user wanted to force whoever handled that bug report in Qualtech to really read carefully to the documentation and get an old point. KDE has a lot of those extra rules in the end. A lot. It's the trolls who were guilty because we did the same thing. But mine the board. Also, mind the inheritance structure. Sometimes you make an API and it looks fine, but because the class inherits from another class, you kind of suck in a lot of the other API and you need to consider that. Here's a bad example. It's the good old Qtool button. If you look at the properties that a Qtool button offers, it has name from QObject, it has caption from QRegion, this is Qt3. It has text from QButton, and it has text label from QToolButton. Now, what is what? And imagine you show that code to a user, create ToolButton, set caption to hello. What do you expect? In Q4, we tried to change these things. So QObject has an object name property, QWidget has a window title property, and AbstractButton has text. Toolbutton doesn't need anything. But those things happen if you don't take the inheritance hierarchy into account. Just look at the details. Are you kidding me? Okay, I jump over this. Okay, you can read some of the slides. Static polymorphism is pretty interesting, but yeah, you can't understand it from just reading the slide. So let's do QA. Think about an API as a user interface. The first revision of an API is never a great one. You must test APIs. This is important for everything that is in KDE. And how do we test APIs? You kind of write an it's hard to write an acceptance test for an API. But what you can do is you can make use cases. You have to carefully study code that uses the API. Now, an API is beautiful if code written against it is beautiful, not if it just looks nice on the screen. So the way of doing it is when you design a new class, write use cases, write code that uses the class the way you intend it to be, and then look at that code and have the mindset is, can somebody who doesn't know my class, from just reading that code, understand what it does, understand what the component does? Is that really optimal? Does it feel like something? Does it feel clumsy? Do you have to write things where you think, oh, didn't I just write that? Didn't I just set that property? Why do I have to do it this way? So always look at the code that uses the API. and then have somebody else use it without any documentation. Give somebody the API and say, oh, do something useful with it. This is the task. Can you make it? It's a test within the main email. And then, document it. For classes, don't just write functional documentation. KDE has that problem, that we have a lot of functional documentation. The functional documentation is pretty good. It's precise, it's correct. But we don't have a class overview. That means you have no protection against functions that end up in a class and shouldn't be there. So the basic rule is try to write a class overview that covers basically all the members of the class and groups them, and structures them. And if you can't do that, because it seems like if you end up with the documentation, this class really does four different things, A, B, that then you immediately see, okay, something's wrong. The last one is get your names right. Names are as important as get documentations. And as with anything, as with everything, the first name is never the correct one. Yeah, I have a lot of stuff about naming. General rules, naming classes, naming members, parameters, enums, Boolean properties. Yeah, let's just do it. I think this is the most one of the more important slides. If you create a new class or a new function and you need to find a good name, document the item. Item means here, class, function, or whatever, parameter. Document the item and use your first sentence as inspiration. If you start with this function does or this thing returns bar, mostly in the first sentence. If you use the words that you use in the first sentence when you describe something, you probably find your name. If that doesn't help you, talk to a friend or talk to your dog, if you have one, and explain what the item does. And by explaining that, listen to your words, and you'll probably end up finding your name. If you cannot find a precise name, that is a good indication that the thing maybe shouldn't exist. And don't use names with or and and in it, because that's not really precise. You have that in some cases. Sometimes you need to invent a new name, and you should be open to that, but it happens very seldom. Examples for invented names are widget, focus, body in Qlabel. But yeah, be careful with that. Grouping classes. Here's an abbreviation thing. Last one. Avoid using abbreviations. Look at that function in the API. That's something we currently have in queue. Qsize policy colon colon instead horror stretch. SN. We set the horror stretch to science fiction. There's absolutely no reason whatsoever to not write the complete thing. Set horror on the scratch. Scratch. Saving 4 keystrokes. Enumerators are really important. Keep in mind that an enumerator value is typically used without the type. So you end up, if you have an enum corner that you call top left and bottom right, or an enum case sensitive, and you call it insensitive and sensitive, then you end up having code like as dot index of needle, comma, insensitive. Now, if you know that is a string and that is a string, you can kind of figure out that this code may be about case, but you also pollute the namespace with a word like insensitive. So it's important when you do enums that you kind of duplicate the name of the type into the enum. So if you write case insensitive, the specification of the enum, the declaration looks a lot more elaborated. It feels like clumsy to repeat case all the time. But the code looks a lot more beautiful and it's a lot easier to understand. So always have the type somewhere in here, either at the beginning, in case, or at the end of the word. Boolean properties are the most important ones. We have guidelines that I try to formalize how we do it in Q.
And this is something that KDE can look at and maybe adjust or just use if it fits.
Yeah, I would love to go through that case study of Qprogress bar, because this is the way it looks in currently in Qt4, you know, which I think is a horrible API, but we are running out of time, so I will simply publish that, and you can have a look at that online. I have 3 more minutes if you have questions.
Well, we have 3 more minutes plus questions.
Oh, do we need questions?
The audience, but you can go 3 more minutes without questions.
Okay, let's look at that API, Qprogress bar. Who has used Qprogress bar? Ooh, choice of that. Okay. Well, what do we have here? We have public functions, total steps, and progress. Progress is not quite related to total steps. Where does the steps word come from? And why is progress really a part of steps? So this is totally wrong, and you should really end up having something like slider or spin box and have minimum and maximum value. This is to minimize the number of concepts we have. This group here is worse. It has a concept of a progress string, a percentage visible, and a set percentage visible. What is the progress string typically looks like 15%. What does percentage visible mean? Should it remove the percentage sign, or does it remove the whole string? In fact, it removes the whole string. So percentage visible says whether the progress string is visible or not. So the naming is wrong, those functions are not related. The center indicator talks about the alignment of the progress string if the percentage is visible. So indicator, progress string, and percentage are 3 words for the same thing in one API. Here we have set indicator follow style or set center indicator. This is really 2 bools that set the alignment. What you really would have is you would have alignment, which can be left, right, center, or auto. That means it follows the style or the right of the locale. Here you have a wrong name. Central indicator doesn't sound like a Boolean getter function. It sounds like central indicator. Or it sounds like something that returns the center indicator. Because you have like several indicators and please return the center indicator. So this is wrong naming. That's a Boolean thing. But the total favorite is the API for subclassing and changing the progress string and the percentage and the indicator, the set indicator function. It takes a progress and total steps and reference the progress string, and it asks you to return true if you change the string. How can we sell that stuff? So go through all those things and add text. So this is really what the API should have looked like. You have minimum and maximum and a value. You have a text. You have a function to set the text visible or invisible. You have alignment of the text. And the cool thing is, because the text function is virtual, you just re-implement text and do whatever you want. For that API, I don't think any experienced Qt programmer needs any documentation whatsoever. It just asks the same calls. My time's out. Thank you for listening.
Thanks a lot, Matthias. We can have a number of questions. And we don't have any microphone for the audience here, so please speak up.
Do you think it's feasible to write a program class or medical test APIs for implementing this kind of syntax? Not syntax, naming?
I don't think you can automate it. A lot of it is judgment. It's just like you can't make a program that that says, oh, this is a good dialogue form or a bad one. It's the same thing. It's because we are talking about human machine interaction, not machine machines. Yeah.
Are you against get as a method name prefix? You know, you're just saying you don't have any gets in the example,
yeah.
So I assume you don't like it.
No, we decided against, that was before my time, we don't use the pattern. There's a famous pattern, that is, if you call have a property foo, you call set foo, and to get the value back, you just call get foo, which is a good pattern in that you don't need your brain to create Boolean functions or getter functions. You don't need to think about it. It's very easy, very natural. The problem is it doesn't look nice. If widget get visible, do something, doesn't look the same like is widget if widget is visible. So if you think of the written code as it should be beautiful and more English-like and easy to read, get is a very machine-like thing. We do use get for for functions that have several output parameters, but then we also use pointers. So qrect get coordinates, this is an abbreviation. here we use get, because then in the code you can see this function actually retrieves values rather than doing something weird with pointers. But we decided against using get for get. Yeah.
It'd be really good to stick consistently with is, because in Ruby, for instance, you don't say is, you have a question mark at the end of the method name. So if is was always used, and you're using the cute Ruby bindings, you would always know that it meant is rather than has or something else. You know, that's
I think
quite
the
important.
Ruby bindings, just like any bindings, they should look at all the available metadata. Because all this, I wouldn't even go through the getter, setter and getter functions of Boolean properties, I would go through the property system. So the binding generator, if it wouldn't go through the C bindings, could actually have access to, oh, this is a property, cool, I use whatever that property syntax the language have. Like in BASIC, you would just write the name of the property to set it and to read it. You wouldn't even call set, and so should the bindings.
Well, in Ruby, you go, you've got an assignment type thing, so that's a synonym for set.
Yeah.
And you can just do that, you don't have to look up the metadata.
Yeah,
whereas I can't with has and is, because it's just not consistent. I could sort of look it up,
right.
But it's a bit messy.
But
there could be two,
The bindings should look up the property system and figure out, oh, this is just a set of functions for a property, so I do whatever it's appropriate for properties.
But it would certainly really help if everyone just stuck to is.
Yeah, but we can't do that, because we only use the prefix where it's required. We don't use, for example, some Boolean properties are plural, then we must use R. And our dark windows enabled doesn't quite sound the same, so we would just say dark windows enabled. So this, the grammar has to be correct, so we can't just do it with the same feature.
Another one is overloaded methods, which only differ by an enum type.
Are you Richard Dale?
Yes.
Yeah.
I always have been, in fact.
Can we just talk after the...
Yeah. Well, the question about the enums, there's a password class in KDE, and two of the methods just differ by an enum type.
Yeah.
And if in a language binding like Java you haven't got enums, and they're both ints, and you have to rename them, and it's just the method names, it makes it messy if you overload just on that.
Yeah. What was the question?
Don't do it in KDE 4, please. Well, I've worked around the problem, but not with Java. You have to rename the methods because the enums are just ints. And,
yeah.
Yep. More questions? Up there?
Will users of all the QT progress bar be given a refund?
Talk to me afterwards.
Come on, ask an intelligent question.
Is there some useful rules for writing cute bindings to underlying C libraries?
not a good
no
idea.
I'm sure there are, but no explicit one. No, we haven't written down and what library do you have in mind?
I work USB, Universal Serial Bus, and I wrote a really horrible set of Qt bindings that I'd like to throw away and start again.
What we typically do, I mean, all of Qt is essentially binding object-oriented C++ abstracted binding to some C libraries. Almost all of the APIs we're using, FreeType, Renderer, Axlib, GDI, whatever, is C libraries. So, I mean, all of Qt is bindings to C libraries. What I think is, whenever I've seen a C library, if your object binding kind of reflect how the C library looks like, probably not a good thing. You probably just want to look at the functionality level of the C library. What's the functionality? You start from that. Design a new API based on the functionality, on the task you want to achieve, and then you see how you can map that to whatever the C library offers. I think that's probably the better approach.
We may have time for one more question.
Do you think you could turn your presentation into some kind of rule book which we could use as a guideline for cleaning up the KDE API for KDE 4?
Yes, I do.
Okay, then. Thanks a lot, Matthias. And the next talk will start in 10 minutes.